Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Now that Joe Biden is president and Democrats narrowly control the Senate and the House, is it a new day for America and for Portland? Today we talk with Portland Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, now the longest-serving commissioner, besides Mayor Ted Wheeler, about the challenges we still face in Portland despite a hopeful change of course coming from Washington, D.C. Joanne, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara. It's so good to be back.
Well, the last time we were talking, which was just about 5 months ago, the Trump administration had just designated Portland as a terrorist jurisdiction. Now we are actually recording this on February 11th. It's the third day of the second impeachment trial for Donald Trump. And we're looking at the results of the kinds of violence that Trump stirred up over the 4 years of being president and the 1 year before that of running for president. I wonder how you see the juxtaposition of the way that the Trump administration and his allies always pointed to the violence of a place like Portland and looking at the kind of violence that really erupted on January 6th.
It is absolutely fascinating to me, Barbara, that we developed new words and new understandings when white men create the kind of violence that we saw on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. We should call it exactly what it was. It was a terrorist takeover of our government, or attempted terrorist takeover of our government. And I have to say, as someone who's been working on police reform for 32 years, I was absolutely appalled at seeing the narrative that was created around, they call them insurgents, right? All of a sudden we have a new word, insurgent. They were not insurgents, they were terrorists with intending to disrupt and or take over our federal government. I am also very aware of the difference in consequences. Had Black Lives Matter protesters or indigenous people who had been standing up for water and making sure that everybody had access to clean water, if any of those groups had showed up at the U.S. Capitol and actually done what these white men did, they would be under federal jails. And then I continue to read about people who were involved in that mass protest on January 6th being given leave by the court to go on vacation to Mexico, not actually being held in jail, not even going to jail. And the charges are that I've seen so far are not the the top level crimes that they actually, we saw with our own eyes, they participated in. So I am not optimistic that we will see justice from what happened on January 6th. And it just reinforces that in this country, there are two justice systems, one for white men and one for everybody else.
Well, I know you mentioned before we started recording that you haven't been watching the impeachment trial that much, but I have. And one of the things that's jumped out to me is what an amazing case the impeachment managers are making and showing the whole chronology of how Trump, from the very beginning of his presidential campaign, has been escalating this acceptance of this kind of violence and inciting this kind of violence. And though maybe the Justice Department isn't using the terminology that you would like, a lot of the House Democrats are using terms that you would probably agree with the severity of how serious these crimes are. But one of the things that keeps jumping out to me as I'm watching this footage, and they're showing pretty amazing footage of what happened on January 6th, is the difference of scale and the difference of intent and the difference in, well, the whole idea of violence. That I think about all the demonstrations that we've had in support of Black lives, in support of environmental issues, in support of justice. And I keep flashing back to, oh, I was involved in an occupation of a state capitol a little over a year ago when about 1,000 people or more marched into the Oregon State Capitol, sat on the ground and sang for 3 hours. And then people did sit in Governor Kate Brown's office and again sang and talked and had dialogue. And what it seems to me that people on the left are trying to do when we do have civil disobedience, which is quite different from an armed insurrection, that it's about dialogue. And I just wanted to kind of get your sense of like watching this level of violence and being able to speak back to the people who keep equating violence on the left with the violence that we saw on January 6th and that we've been seeing for the last 4 years under Trump.
Right. I would say 5 years, right? I mean, when you have someone at the highest level of government in the United States that continues to spew hateful nasty, racist, homophobic, anti-woman rhetoric. And what 45 did was actually allow white supremacists and our society to be vocal, to be public, right? Prior to 45, we did not have white supremacists walking down the streets, marching in the streets in the city of Portland. Prior to 45, we did not see visually the difference between how the police interacted and engaged with white supremacists as compared to Black Lives Matter protesters. There is no comparison between what happened on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol and the months and months and months of tens of thousands of people taking to the street, demanding justice and demanding police accountability and demanding that Black Lives Matters, right? They're so far apart, it is just insulting when people try to equate the two, right? One is about losing power, which is what we saw on January 6th, that white men were willing to terrorize the U.S. Capitol and the people in it because they were losing power. What we see on the streets over the summer, throughout the entire summer, were people standing up for justice for Black lives. And we saw people of all races, all creeds, all ages, over and over and over again standing up. And as is traditional, when Black people are standing up for justice, the systems of policing, what do? They get more aggressive. We saw this in the 60s when the civil rights movement happened. I was reminding some young people recently that this is not new. And why do you think Black people in the 60s dressed up in their Sunday best before they went out and protest? Because the assumption that they made was, we are in our Sunday best, and we know we're going to be brutalized. So they were trained to not fight back, right? People didn't just do it like out of the goodness of their heart. They were well trained, they were well dressed, but guess what? They got brutalized by police. They got police dogs released on them. They had water hoses on them. And so what we saw this summer is really not different. It's just different tools that the police used to try to silence those voices. And I think it was anger that so many other people who had not experienced police violence in the past actually had that lived experience themselves. I was just saying this to Chief Lavelle the other day. That bell can't be unrung, right? Now that you have a whole generation now that are terrified of police, right? You can't unring that bell, and you can't go out and demand that you build trust. You can't build trust. Trust is earned, and you will get trust when people see you acting in a trustworthy way, right? We're a long way from that locally and at the national level.
Well, as you're describing the past, I'm remembering my own fear of the police when I was a hippie in the late 60s and 70s and probably 80s. I was raised to, you know, trust our policemen and think the policeman was there to help us. But when I became a hippie radical, and also it had to do with smoking pot as well, so that was an outlaw.
Right.
Every time I saw a police car, let alone a police officer in front of me, I would freeze. And I got over that actually during the Measure 9 campaign in 92, because the police were very supportive of the gay and lesbian community. And Tom Potter, the chief of police, had a gay daughter, and he was with us. I've, of course, lost that again. And I think about how it took 30 years for me to develop a sense of security around police and how easily that can break. The thing that's interesting now, listening to the impeachment trial, is there's an awful lot of honoring of the Capitol Police and the D.C. police, who did the best job they could. So there's two parts to that. First of all, what do you think of that kind of honoring? And the second part of it is, why did they have so little preparedness for this?
I'll do the second one first. The fact that they were unprepared for what all of us knew were going to be lots and lots and lots of people, thousands of people coming to the U.S. Capitol because they had been asked to do that by 45. The fact that we knew they were coming, it just reinforces for me the difference between how police prepare when Black and brown people are coming to protest and what happens when white people are coming to protest. They could have prepared. I mean, D.C. has more police than any other city on the planet. And they have so many resources that could have been made available to them. And honestly, they thought, hey, clearly they were in alignment with the philosophical approach that these folks were taking. And I do feel for the officers who were in the Capitol, who were really totally overwhelmed with the number of people that came in. But I also saw officers holding the door open to let people in, right? What I know for sure is that white supremacy is throughout law enforcement in the United States of America. We've seen that in Portland, where when the Proud Boys protest, you don't see any riot gear anywhere. You see very relaxed police officers. And then a hint of a Black Lives Matter protest requires riot gear from head to toe and the most aggressive police actions imaginable. I have watched police watch Proud Boys beat up people for no reason, just stop their cars and start beating up people on the sidewalk, and there's been no repercussions for that. We have to root out white supremacists within our policing agencies, and we have to do it quickly. Have they always been there? Absolutely, right? But what we've seen with this Capitol event, and I still say it was a terrorist attack, this terrorist attack on the U.S. Capitol, was that they were too relaxed. Law enforcement was way, way, way too relaxed, and they just thought, oh, these are our allies, these are our comrades, these are folks that are here to stand up for white men not losing power. And so we see the repercussions of that. I mean, that could have been 100 times worse. And I am just so grateful that there were some really smart law enforcement and people within the Capitol. And let me also say it didn't go unnoticed by me who cleaned up that mess in the Capitol after these white nationalists actually destroyed a lot of what was inside the U.S. Capitol. I tell you, I was struck by a picture on January 6th that evening on the news when I saw black people sweeping up the glass inside the U.S. Capitol, cleaning up the mess. And I thought to myself, well, isn't this normal, right? That white men come in and destroy it, and here we have black men in there cleaning up the mess, trying to put things back in order so that the work could continue.
Senator Cicilline, who's the Democratic other senator from Rhode Island who doesn't get as much notice as his comrade Whitehouse, he gave a very impassioned speech just before you and I started talking, and he was talking about all the different people who hadn't been noticed before, who were terrorized and terrified and really threatened by this horrible event that happened on the 6th of January. And he's described the janitors. He did this whole tribute to the janitors. I mean, this is, again, things that are making me a little bit more optimistic about hearing the way that the House Democrats, at least, are responding to this. And he was describing this particular black janitor who was describing to the press how humiliated he felt and how sickened he felt by having to clean up feces that were smeared on the wall and blood and all this broken glass. And I felt like the way that Cicilline was describing it was with incredible empathy. And it made me think that we are finally acknowledging the janitorial staff and all the support people who are largely people of color. So I wonder if that gives you any sense of hope that this is at least being acknowledged in the hall of the Senate today.
Well, yes, it gives me a little hope. But what I also know is that if allowed, we will go back to business as usual. I think now that the impeachment trial is actually highlighting things that we all know, that we have this very, very, very unequal justice system. My fear, and I see it here locally, is that there is a desire to say, oh, that was last year. Now let's just go back and do same old, same old. Let's just use new language and new rhetoric, but let's not fundamentally change things. I will be deeply disappointed if at the end of the day that we have not transformed every level of government. The fact that there are Republicans that got reelected after supporting the most ill-qualified president that we've ever had in this country, and they are still there, and they still are propagating conspiracy theories about stolen elections. I mean, they tried to steal it by taking mailboxes out of communities, by removing polling places in communities. But I also have to say that a lot of blame lies with both parties. Democrats are not unscathed. Democrats could have, when the Voting Rights Act was gutted, they could have taken action to ensure that every American could vote by mail or would not be standing in line 4, 5, 6, 7 hours to vote. In America today, if you're Black, the chance of you standing in line for 4, 5, 6, 7 hours is huge, especially if you live in southern states, right? So Democrats have nothing to be proud of yet until they actually do something that's meaningful. They could have done that a long time ago, right? And they chose not to. I'm waiting for the trial to be over so that we can actually have a national reckoning. Democrats owe Black and brown people an apology, right? We can't start talking about unity until we talk about the lack of action that has happened over and over and over again. But the fact that we have a lot of those same people back in Congress again is very troubling to me. They haven't been held accountable for the destruction that they caused. And honestly, a lot of them sat back and allowed this destruction to happen. And they said nothing. Where were they? Republican and Democrat alike.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland. Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Portland Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about the challenges we still face in Portland despite a hopeful change of course coming from Washington, D.C. So let's get to that hopeful change of course now. I've kind of facetiously called this show A New Day in Portland. Because we've been talking a lot about a new day. We always talk about that when there's political change. Let's first of all talk about how it is a new day before we talk about all the hard work we have ahead. So what was your first response to some of the political changes that you've seen happen since we talked in September?
Well, the political changes that have happened is we have a new city council. I am giddy about the new city council that we have here in Portland. We have Commissioner Carmen Rubio, the first Latinx city council member in the history of the city of Portland. We have the third Black man who ever served on city council, Mingus Mapps. We have Dan Ryan, who started in August, or a month before the September extravagant, who is a gay white male who has lived with HIV, being HIV positive for a long, long, long time. And we have Mayor Ted Wheeler, who's back. Mayor Ted Wheeler is now the traditional politician, if you will, right? He is the only one who has served in a variety of elected offices. He's done that. I met him when he was running to be Multnomah County chairperson. So we have a city council now that is embedded in community, right? So when I first got to City Hall and people were telling me, well, this is how we do that, or you can't ask that, or, you know, you have to do X, Y, Z. My new colleagues don't have to fight those barriers, right? Because I said then, I was elected by the people. I wasn't elected by systems of the way you've always done things, right? And I am loving my new colleagues. I'm loving the questions that they ask. I'm loving where their priorities are. And so with this new city council that took their seat on January 2nd, I see an opportunity for real transformation in this city, and I am giddy about that. What I know is that we will make decisions differently. Even the conversations are different. The conversations are different because they're based on people, and they're not based on policy, right? They're based on how does this impact the most vulnerable people in our community. As you know, Barbara, last year the city council passed a resolution that said it would prioritize Black, Indigenous, and other community of color voices in our decision-making as we move forward. But it's easy to say those things. It's easy to pass resolutions. What does that look like in real life? Well, what it looks like in real life is that Mayor Wheeler and I are going to co-host a Black male town hall next month for 14 to 44-year-old Black men. We are in the midst in this city of a gun violence epidemic. And it's not just Portland, it's happening all over the country because it happens anytime there's economic insecurity, right? But I was so appreciative that Mayor Wheeler said, well, look, we cannot talk about any kind of enhanced policing without talking directly with the people who will be most impacted by that effort. And who's most impacted? Black men, 14 to 44 years old, right? So I'm looking forward to that town hall. and we're not allowing organizations to be represented. We want to talk to people directly, right? So that's going to happen in March. I'm in the process now of working with the mayor's Portland Community Engaged Policing Committee to put together a proposal for a truth and reconciliation process. And it has to be a process that is big, that is meaningful, and that comes out with some priorities for us to work through. And the way I am seeing this happen is I've talked to Chief Lavelle, who is our police chief, as you know, and said, Portland Police isn't ready for public truth and reconciliation. Portland Police has a lot of work they have to do behind closed doors to even prepare for a truth and reconciliation process. And to his credit, Chief Lavelle agreed that he would participate and he would have his officers participate in a truth and reconciliation process. But I see work having to happen with them behind closed doors that may take 6 to 8 months to have that completed before they are then ready for real community dialogue. But while that's happening inside the police bureau, we also have to have a bigger community truth and reconciliation process to address the generational harm, the racially unjust systems that we have in place. We've got to create a place where we can have those conversations that are well facilitated, that allow people to speak their truth. But I think the most important part about that process is prioritizing what do we agree collectively that we're going to work on in the next the next 2 years, right? Because we didn't create these systems in one budget cycle or two or 10, and we're not going to fix them in one budget cycle, two or 10. So let's get a prioritized list, and let's as a community agree, we're going to be laser focused on addressing these two areas now for the next 2 years. And then the third part, of course, is bringing the community and the police together to have that real community truth and reconciliation process between the police and the community. Then we'll be ready to start talking about what are we building for the future. So that's happening. All those things are happening. I'm also working with the local public safety coordinating council. All 36 counties have them. It is a legislatively mandated. I am now the co-chair with Chairwoman Deborah Cafori. And we are in the process of actually developing revolutionary changes to our justice system in Multnomah County. Because though I can work on police and say we need less police and we need police to be more focused on solving crime, the reality is police is the front door into our criminal justice system, right? And so if we need less police, that means we also need less assistant DAs. Because we're not going to be prosecuting people for misdemeanor crimes or crimes of homelessness, right? So if we need less DAs, that means we also need less county sheriffs because we're not going to be jailing less people. So all these systems have the opportunity to reinvest those dollars in community solutions. We are working with Dr. John Jay from Boston University, who I have been convening. We will have a third meeting at the end of this month. With elected leaders from Multnomah County, the sheriff, the police chief from Gresham, talking about promising practices nationally and interrupting violence in communities. So we're looking at putting together a violence interrupter program where we are paying community members who may have been formerly incarcerated, who may have been former gang members, who actually have relationships with young people who potentially may be involved in gun violence, to actually be the interrupters, to actually help redirect their focus to things that matter. I'm talking to the state about if we would give a stipend to people coming back from incarceration, a $1,600 stipend for the first 6 months, so that people can get grounded and have a chance to be successful when they come back from incarceration, that would be a much better investment than all the money we put into parole and probation and supervision today, right? So again, all of our systems are broken and there's just so much work to do. But the good news is that there's a lot of people in positions of power that actually are ready for this moment, have been waiting for this moment, right? And so that's what I'm seeing every day. I'm seeing people in elected position who understand the tinkering around the edges is over, right? We can no longer keep tinkering around the edges and pretend somehow we're moving the ball, because we're not. We must change outcomes, and we have to be intentional about making sure that where we're investing, we're getting the right return for those investments. Suffice it to say that there's a lot happening internally, but I also am very aware that people outside of City Hall may think that we have just gone to sleep because we're not being really effective at actually translating what we're doing inside City Hall outside. I think once we have the town hall next month, that will start helping people see that we really are moving forward. We had a work session with all our first responder bureaus last week. I would also encourage people to listen to that because it is insightful about how we're moving as a city.
I'm kind of curious about your new fellow council person, Mingus Mapps, because I was actually pretty confused about him during the election campaign. And one of the alarms that went off for a lot of people was that he had received a sufficient amount of campaign money from the police union. I'm happy to hear that you feel really positive about him, and I'm curious to know where he stands around police issues, where he stands around some of the environmental issues, where he seemed, when he was running, to be really opposed to Chloe Udalie's positions on those issues.
Commissioner Udalie had a lot of opponents that were running that were just running that they were not Commissioner Udalie, right? That was their platform. And what I know is that there's a huge difference in skills and expertise running for office that then serving in office. And I am happy to say that my experience thus far has been that Commissioner Mapps is open. And in fact, everything I've talked to him about that I am passionate about when it comes to transforming policing in Portland, he's been very supportive of. And, you know, I did not support him when he was running. I was going to stay out of that race. And honestly, until the end, when I finally decided that I needed Commissioner Udalie back, when she did not prevail. And I had said this to Commissioner Mapps when he was running. If you win, I will do everything I can to help you with your onboarding and to help you get acclimated to City Hall. And I've kept that commitment. So I meet weekly with him. I meet weekly with Commissioner Rubio. And my role is to help them understand how City Hall operates and how they can maneuver through the City Hall process. And I have found both of them to be very open, very committed to many of the things that I care about. So it's early. We haven't worked together for a month yet, right? It has been a little over a month. I forgot we're in February now, right? The year is like moving quickly. I'm cautiously optimistic. I am sure there will be areas where we will disagree. But I believe that as of right now, we are both committed to building a good collegial work relationship.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFGL PFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Portland Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about the challenges we still face in Portland despite a hopeful change of course coming from Washington, D.C. So one of the hopeful signs coming from D.C., we hope, is some more money coming to cities, states, and regions. How hopeful are you that that's going to actually transpire? And if it does, what would that mean for the city of Portland and Multnomah County?
Well, let me just say that there was an article that came out yesterday that said if we don't address the rent moratorium, it will cost the state of Oregon over $3 billion in additional social service supports. Right now, we have people that are desperate because they have not been able to pay their mortgage, they have not been able to pay their rent, and I feel really frustrated that what we continue to do is just punt it down the road, right? We have extended the moratorium twice so far. It's now scheduled to expire in July, but without federal intervention to actually forgive this rent/mortgage for the year of the pandemic, most of our community will never, ever, ever be able to catch up. It is just an unrealistic expectation that people who are already struggling to pay rent are somehow magically going to be able to pay back a year's worth of rent in a couple of months. That's just not realistic. So I am putting all my pressure on our federal delegation to make sure that that is absolutely at the top of the list. What the state has done so far, I find a bit perplexing. because I honestly think what we need to be doing a much better job of is putting money in the hands of people who need it. And we have not done that. When the state passed assistance for renters, the money didn't go to the renters. It will go directly to the apartment owners. I found that offensive because it felt a lot like Big Brother as compared to letting households decide what their priorities were for those resources. We instead had landlords apply, and some of those same landlords may still be evicting people the moment they have the chance to do so. So with no assurances from them that they in fact are not gonna evict folks. So we need to make sure that there's a clean slate that community members can build from. And that is true for mortgage holders as well as for renters. Because I know that if somebody, if you own a building and people aren't paying rent, you can't pay your mortgage, right? So we have to do that, and that has to happen from the federal level. Then we need to make sure that the federal dollars that are coming in, that they are providing federal dollars for local governments so that those local governments can invest those dollars in their local communities. I was so appalled by what was supposed to be CARES Act funding and who benefited from the CARES Act funding. And I have to say, I've talked to my congressional representatives and said, I can't believe you supported this. And they said, well, you know, it was a compromise. No, it wasn't. If you'd have told the American people that this is what I'm being asked to vote on, I suspect most working people would have said, vote no, right? They would not say it's okay to give billionaires billions more dollars and then give us a trinkle, right? No one would have thought that that was an acceptable outcome. Again, that's why I say we can't just blame Republicans for this lack of action. We must blame the people that say they represent us as well. And that's Democrats and Republicans.
I was kind of curious, because I got a sense that some of the multi-billion dollar corporations that got some of that money, that it was sort of a subterfuge, that it was maybe that the act was written too broadly, but it wasn't the intention of a lot, particularly of our congressional delegation, for it to be used the way it was. One of the most egregious examples locally that I learned about was that Northwest Innovation Works, which is trying to build this methanol refinery in Kalama, they took CARES money, even though there's nobody working for them, and it's basically owned by the Chinese government. So that was an example of a giant loophole. But is it that there were loopholes that were taken advantage of, or was the law actually written that way?
It was written to make sure that billionaires could take advantage of it, and our folks voted for it, right? And you can't just say people were desperate, so we had to. They didn't have to. They voted for it because, again, you know, billionaires support congressional candidates, right, from both parties. So until we get money out of our federal system, we will continue to have this kind of ridiculous legislation that is sold to us that somehow this is helping us. It didn't help us. Helped billionaires a lot, but it didn't help. When you give somebody one check for a year, how appalling to say that we gave money to the American people, right? That was pretty appalling. So again, I don't let Democrats off the hook because we send them there to fight for us and not to fight for billionaires, right? But at the end of the day, what we got as compared to what billionaires got, there's no excuse. You can't tell me that we didn't know that. When I asked, well, how do we make sure that businesses owned by people of color benefit? I was told, oh yeah, that'll be in the next bill. Cause yeah, we didn't put that in this bill, right? It's like, really?
Well, what do you think about the bill that's before Congress right now? Do you think that's better than the one that passed last March?
What I'm hearing, and again, I haven't read that bill yet, so I don't know all the details, but I am very concerned that Democrats are trying to figure out where a cap is. Who's, if you make $50,000, should you be eligible? If you make $100,000? I mean, it's like, really? People have been desperate for over a year, and now we have Democratic, and let me say, they're millionaires as well. Democratic millionaires deciding whether somebody who makes $100,000 is worthy of some assistance. There's something wrong with that whole concept. What I expect a democratically led Congress to do is to get dollars out the door as quickly as possible into the hands of people who need it. What I don't expect is for them to be debating what the appropriate amount is and whether or not there should be a cutoff. I want to be clear, there should be no cutoff because everybody that works for a living has had some level of devastation over the last year. And so send the money out. Don't spend all your time debating about whether you should exclude some people, because you don't do that when rich people have access to dollars, right? We didn't do that with the first package, so why would we be doing that now when we're talking about individuals who need support?
How about some of the other measures in the bill, though, that would hopefully be bringing money to local jurisdictions?
So as far as I know so far, there has been no local dollars that have been attached to the bill. Maybe it's changed since I last heard about it, but it was going to go to the state. If it goes to the state, the chance of Portland getting any is pretty nil, right? I try not to even bother with the federal stuff until it actually passes because it changes so rapidly, almost on a daily basis. What I know is that if we don't give money to local governments, that means the people in those local communities will continue to suffer, right? It's going to be years before in Portland that we economically recover. And if we're not getting federal assistance, it's going to be devastating for our community.
Well, I want to talk about some of the most egregious examples of how much this community is suffering. And I think the first one that comes to most people's minds is homelessness. And so I wonder, first of all, some of what you see as some of the reasons why it's taking the shape it's taking, which is two parts. One is there's many more people on the streets than there were. The second part is that it's really out of control, particularly in downtown Portland. It's becoming insufferable, not just for the people who are on the streets, but people who live in homes but walk on the streets. So I'm wondering if the city has any plans in the very near future to really address that, and if it's going to take federal dollars in order to really adequately address it.
Well, you may remember, Barbara, that the last three mayors declared a housing emergency, right? And since this pandemic, I will tell you that for the first 6-7 months, we added not one new bed for people who were houseless. We added locations because of the social distancing requirements, but we added not one new bed. It was not until my office started advocating for the C3PO camps, which are the four outdoor camps that were created downtown, that the first new beds for houseless community members were created. And these were on the ground, sleeping bags with sleeping arrangements on the ground. Have we done an effective job of addressing our houseless population? Not at all. And what happened when everything closed down was the places where people who were houseless went during the day were no longer accessible, right? And so houseless people started congregating in places where they could get some basic support. That's why Street Roots and Sisters of the Road and Transition Projects have so many people just everywhere. But we saw this coming even before the pandemic. You could not go to a freeway overpass and not see people in tents living under them. We are in a crisis. And normally, if it was a crisis, what would you do? The Red Cross would come in. We would set up tents. We would triage people. We would take care of the most severely in need people first. And we would have a plan for how we would process the rest. And I think what we're seeing on the street is the outcome of neglect, of neglecting people who cannot afford to live in our city. And if we don't do something to prevent evictions, it's going to be 10 times what you're seeing today. It breaks my heart every single time I see one of these camps with garbage piled up, with people who look hopeless because they don't see any path towards anything else. Even with the resources that we spend, and let me say the city spends $45 million a year, the county spends $45 million a year that goes to the Joint Office for Houseless Services. And I have had to fight inside City Hall to get us to address people living on the street because their instinct is permanent housing first, and we just have to get people in the housing. But we cannot afford to forget people who are living on our street. And to me, I'm happy that Commissioner Ryan is now the housing commissioner because I think he comes with that same vision that I do. We have to do both. We have to address the people that are on our street, and we have to find permanent housing people can afford to live in. And we won't build our way out of it. It is my hope that with a new energy with Commissioner Ryan, that we will be much more creative about what's possible. So for example, one of the things that's coming to City Council soon is a change in land use law to allow more flexibility around creating temporary housing structures, right? And it begs the question, if we're about to do that, why are we trying to move Hazelnut Grove?
What's Hazelnut Grove?
Hazelnut Grove is a self-managed camp that's been in North Portland since the days of Charlie Hales. There's been this narrative around where Hazelnut Grove is located. It is more susceptible to fire damage. That's not true, because I have fire bureaus in my portfolio, and I can tell you that the fire bureau has worked with the residents of Hazelnut Grove to do fire education. And in fact, they have a very good relationship with the residents of Hazelnut Grove. But there's a church that's built tiny homes, St. John's Church, that many of the residents that are currently at Hazelnut Grove have agreed that they want to move into. But there are Hazelnut Grove residents who say, this is home for me. I didn't agree to make this move. But there's just a narrative at the city of Portland that somehow when a small village opens, that Hazelnut Grove will go away. And it is a stupid premise because it's not like houseless people have gone away. And if Hazelnut Grove has been so successful, why would we not continue to support Hazelnut Grove's existence, right? But I am happy to say that the residents have actually, they delivered a petition this week to Commissioner Dan Ryan with, I think, like 4,000 signatures from community residents that say, we want Hazelnut Grove to be here. As many times as the case, there's a neighborhood association that wants them gone, right? They just don't like the look. They don't want them in their neighborhood. They want them gone. But there are so many community members that support them and support their self-governance model. And what I know from my time working on Dignity Village is that the safest camps are those that are self-managed and those where the residents are the ones that dictate what the community norms are there. Those camps don't get calls for police services. They're not dirty. They clean up behind themselves. And they are comfortable places for people to be as they reassess what's next.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFT LP FM and KODX LP FM, KMUN and KCB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Portland Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about the challenges we still face in Portland, despite somewhat of a sea change in Washington, and maybe a sea change, as it sounds like, also in the governance of Portland. One of the big tensions right now, particularly around homelessness, has to do with the tension between the business associations in downtown Portland and the people who are living in the streets in downtown Portland. Well, I read a statistic that pedestrian traffic in downtown is like down by 80%. And I know I go downtown maybe once or twice a month, and it looks really different than it did before the pandemic. So I'm wondering, how do we balance this tension? Because I think it's important that business owners feel safe. It's important that people, the handful of people who are still working downtown, feel safe, and those who go downtown for other services. And it would be great to start bringing life back to downtown Portland. But it seems like while there's so many homeless camps that are just sprawled all over sidewalks and parking lots and places, they're not self-governed and they're not the kinds of homeless camps you were talking about. How do we find some kind of balance?
I think that's a great question, right? And the reality is that downtown Portland will never be the same again. And there are some people who think we're going to flip a switch one day and we're going to go back to business as usual. I think all of us have learned a lot during this pandemic. We have people who traditionally had 10,000 square feet of Class A office space downtown Portland have learned that they can make more money working remotely than they can renting out these fancy office spaces. What we know is tourism will be the very last industry coming back. And so all the international visitors that Portland is known for, that's not coming back for years to come. What we know is that the traditional high cost of renting office space or a storefront space in downtown has made downtown unaffordable for minority and women and other people who would love to be downtown, but have never had an opportunity to do so. And so what I say to downtown business owners is it won't be the same. It will never be the same. It will be new. It'll be different. And you get to be part of reimagining what a post-COVID downtown looks like. For me, because I now have Peabody in my portfolio, I'm looking at how to make downtown car-free. I'm looking at how to make other areas of the city car-free. And I'm looking at how do we create an international district downtown that is reflective of the host of cultural and racial groups that we have, so that it's not just a place for white people to go and eat and hang out and work, right? That's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at building a more multicultural, multi-ethnic downtown coming out of this pandemic. And I have challenged business community. You got to think outside of the box, because if you think we're going to flip a switch and then all of a sudden we're going to be back like we were, that's just not going to happen. Unfortunately, some of the downtown businesses have drank the Kool-Aid of the national narrative of downtown Portland being destroyed. And you know that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you are on national media outlets saying downtown is doomed, it's destroyed, we'll never be able to have business again, guess what? You're going to create that reality for yourself. I'd much rather see businesses who are saying, how do we respond to this new reality that we're in, right? If the owners of those big Class A office space are not going to reduce their rents, guess what? They're going to be empty for a long, long time to come. If they're not thinking about how do we reconfigure our site, so maybe we have a lot of small minority businesses in one site as compared to one big fancy space, they are going to miss the ball. If they are not thinking about how do I make my business attractive, like not make the city, make downtown look like I want it to look, but how do I make my business attractive to people who traditionally may not have even considered my business as an opportunity for a partnership? That's what I hope business leaders are thinking today. But anybody who's sitting back waiting for the city, the state, or the federal government to pour money into the status quo of what used to be, they're going to be in for a very long wait, because that's just not happening.
Well, I'm thinking about the way downtown Portland was when I moved here in 1971, and it was a great place. It had a lot of character and had some really great businesses, and there was a thriving Chinatown, which has moved out to 82nd Street now. Also, it was a place where there were like a lot of hippie businesses. Portland was certainly not a city of lots of people of culture in those days, but it did have this very large counterculture, and the counterculture could afford downtown Portland. Do you see that that's maybe a direction we can go back to? I mean, you're describing making it multicultural, and how do we make it affordable as well?
I think one of the things that I have actually been on the Joint Office of Housing Services on, if we're not prepared to grab up brand new hotels that nobody's ever slept in because they opened just as the pandemic was hitting, or brand new apartment complexes that have been so unaffordable that no one that lives here now can afford to live in them. If we're not ready to buy those up when they go into foreclosure, we will once again miss that opportunity. In 2008, when we had the last economic collapse, we did not do that as a city. So what happened was speculators came in and bought up properties that local governments should have bought up and made sure that they were going to be in use for people who lived in the city before the economic collapse. They failed in 2008, and I'm here to make sure that they don't fail in 2021 to take advantage of those opportunities. I am happy, honestly, at this moment, that we are not attractive to international investors. We've had way too many international investors that build things that was not useful for Portlanders, and now today they sit empty. So I'm looking forward to the opportunity to take advantage of this economic reality that we're in and turn many of those places into places that people can truly afford to live in. The other thing I will say is that what the city has done over many years is when somebody says to you affordable, your next question should be affordable for who? Because when I first got to City Hall, I can't tell you how many presentations I had where people told me they were building affordable housing until I said affordable for who, and then really dig down. Because the median family income in the Portland metro area is $85,700. So when you say you're building affordable housing at 80% of MFI, what you mean is somebody has to make $72,000 to afford that affordable housing unit, right? I don't know too many people making $71,000 a year, much less anybody making $71,000 who thinks that they need affordable housing. Also, I've noticed the inequity in those affordable housing units, right? When you have a market rate building and three apartments are quote-unquote affordable and one's a family unit, I said to a developer, what do you think the life's going to be for that family in a single occupancy building where there's only, you know, one three-bedroom unit, and that's the quote-unquote affordable one, right? And everybody else are single adults. What do you think the life's going to be for that family, right? And we don't make people think about that unless the people in elected office are actually unpacking it in a way. I want to know, how are you going to survive as a low-income family in an apartment that's built for market-rate renters?
Well, one last thing I wanted to talk about today, and that's the environment. It was interesting what you're saying about making more of Portland car-free. And I'm wondering what other environmental initiatives that were in place before the pandemic started, particularly the Clean Energy Fund and things like that. I'm wondering, how are those things taking off? And is there actually movement in that direction?
So, yes, the Portland Clean Energy Fund, in fact, the grant recommendations will be coming to the city council in March. And even though I don't have the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability in my portfolio any longer, I only had it for a sweet short time, I am still in constant communication with both the director, Adrian Durbin, as well as with the program director for the Portland Clean Energy Fund. I am so pleased with the thoughtfulness in which they both developed the application, how they've supported very small community-based organizations to apply for a grant funding. But the rubber will meet the road once those funds are out the door. And I have been constantly monitoring it to make sure that the people who were supposed to benefit from these new funds actually would benefit. That work is moving forward. As you know, there was going to be a vote in January on a proposal from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability about actually taxing polluters. And some of the biggest polluters, believe it or not, are hospitals in the Portland metro area. And it's been, of course, a lot of pushback around taxing hospitals, say, at a time of a pandemic. But hospitals have made a small fortune during the pandemic, whether or not most people know that to be true. That proposal has been delayed, but it will be coming back. The fact that I now have a PBOT, which primarily depends on gas tax revenue and parking revenue, my big priority is finding a new funding structure for the work that I want to do in PBOT, right? We cannot say that we have a climate action plan if we are so dependent on gas tax and parking fees. That's crazy. So we got a lot of work to do to actually walk the talk that we have. Climate justice, environmental justice is still part of the frame that I operate in. And having a PBOT means that I have a bigger role in making sure as we do transportation improvements that we are looking at our options around climate mitigation. I told them today, I said, well, first thing we got to do is get you clean vehicles because you can't keep smogging up the neighborhoods that while you're going to fix pipes and sewers. So yeah, we got a lot of work to do, but I am laser focused on making sure that we live up to our promises and our climate action plan, and that we mitigate any harm that's being done by industries that are trying to circumvent those efforts.
Now, what's this bridge that's going across Flanders Street in Northwest Portland? I've been noticing that for a few months. Is that the vision that Sam Adams had a number of years ago to take the old Sovie Island Bridge and put it over the freeway and make it into a pedestrian bridge, or is it something else?
Honestly, I don't know the history of that bridge. I just know that it's under construction now and people are excited about this bridge being built. I don't know enough about the history, so I'm not even going to try to pretend where it started at. I do know that Bob Stacey at Metro, this has been something that he's worked on for an awful lot of years. And I hear that we may honor him as that bridge gets completed.
It's going to be a pedestrian and bicycle bridge, I'm assuming.
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. That's our future. That's where we're headed.
Well, Joanne, it's always great to talk to you. And I'm glad to hear that you think the city's in such good hands. That's very encouraging, too.
Yes, I'm feeling positive. But, you know, let me just say, put in a plug for activists. We would not be where we are today had it not been for the tens of thousands of people that took to the street. And just like we talk about at the federal level, I want to be really clear. People cannot let their foot up off the pedal now. It is important that you keep the pressure on and help educate my newer colleagues about the sense of urgency. I think my biggest frustration in this job is that I feel like some days I'm the only one that thinks it has to happen now, right? Everybody else is like, oh, well, you know, and it's not that they don't care. It's just that they don't have the sense of urgency that I have. And I want to also encourage your listeners, Barbara, to not abandon Biden like they abandoned Obama, because I think there's this misperception that, yeah, we can now all pat ourselves on the back. We got Biden in. But as we learned with Obama, that's just part one. And if we're not doing part two, which is advocating with everything we have with our congressional delegation, then we will very likely end up not getting even close to what it is we deserve.
Well, thanks a lot, Joanne.
Thank you, Barbara. Always a pleasure. Talk to you next time.
We've been talking with Portland Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Oregon State Representative Karen Power about climate, COVID, and childcare. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with music by Nina Simone. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep